is Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lope today. Now, is it safe to say that a film is a film is a film, or have filmmakers changed over the decades since the studio system collapsed? Well, one person who's more than qualified to answer these questions and more is George Stevens Jr. He worked with his father on a few of that great filmmaker's classics, Shane, Giant, and The Diary of Anne Frank. And in 1967, George Stevens Jr. founded the American Film Institute. In his wonderful new book that just came out from Knopf, Conversations at the American Film Institute with the Great Movie Makers, you can learn about how people like Robert Altman, Roger Corman, Arthur Penn, Neil Simon, and Meryl Streep found their way and did their best work. And I'm so happy to welcome Mr. George Stevens Jr. here today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And what an amazing book. This is, by the way, sometimes people call things tomes. And this is a tome. This is a doorstopper. It's a big book, but it's a great book for the beach this summer because you can just, you know, pour through all these amazing narratives about the movies.
That's not a book you start on page one, or I'd like them to read my introduction, but you can kind of start with Meryl Streep and come back to Robert Altman.
Yeah, you can dip into it. Now this is sort of volume two for you because you wrote an earlier collection talking about the earlier era, the studio system. You know, we talk about that term, the studio system, quite a bit, but it's been so long since we had a studio system in Hollywood. I'm not sure that everybody knows or remembers exactly how it worked. What was the studio system and what led to its collapse?
Well, the studio system really was, there were, I don't know if it was five or six big companies, Warner Brothers, Paramount, Universal, MGM, and they had actors under contract, they had sound stages, they had money, they had distribution, they had theaters, and so they really were the fount of picture making. And in this book, and also in the book about the Golden Age, so much of what the directors talk about is the conflict with studios of how do you make a film that's original and finds an audience with the tendency for studios to have formulas and be sometimes suspicious of things they haven't seen before.
Right, and it's mass production. We just want to get the product out and keep the pipeline going.
Right.
Now, there were sometimes there were consequences of having a roster of actors. Sometimes if an actor wasn't available, they would just look at who else was on the list, on the roster, and say, well, we'll put him. And you said that this affected the making of Shane. How did that play out?
Well, my father was at Paramount, and he was kind of struggling with Paramount. They didn't want to make A Place in the Sun and finally agreed to it, and it was a great success with Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor, and Dad won the Oscar for it. And he had to make one more picture for Paramount, and he had this book, Shane. And Monty Clift and William Holden had agreed to be in the picture, and suddenly, Monty changed his mind, and then Holden dropped out. And so a man named Y. Frank Freeman, who was the head of Paramount Pictures, Dad referred to him as Y. Frank Freeman, and said, well, George, we don't have Monty, we don't have Bill, we can't make this picture. And Dad went over to his office and said, Frank, you have a list of actors in your left-hand drawer. Let's take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And he reluctantly pulled out the list and gave it to Dad. And he looked down and he said, well, he said, Alan Ladd, he's done a lot of good work. Alan Ladd can play Shane. Van Heflin, I just saw him in that Jim Bridger picture. He could play Joe Starrett. And Jean Arthur, I've made three pictures with Jean and she's never let me down. And he sort of boxed them in and they said, they had to say yes. And so he went ahead that summer and made Shane, one of the great Westerns.
So we sometimes demonize the studio system or say that it was just this capitalist construct or factory construct, but it sometimes resulted in, it many times resulted in great movies.
Well, it was the only game in town.
Right.
And yes, and sometimes it's not that the studio is always wrong, but it usually was flying into headwinds to try and make something that was very different.
Right. Now, why, given the fact that Hollywood had such a successful run under the system, why did it eventually come apart?
Really, two things. One, there was an antitrust ruling that said the studios could not own theaters.
Right, because in the old days they did have a complete lock.
Sure,
they
owned, it was the Fox Theater and
right,
the MGM
United
Theater.
Artists, right?
Yeah, and that was number one. And then television. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there were these boxes in people's houses where they would see, for the first time, moving images, and those two factors put a real strain on the studio system.
Mm-hmm. So was it in the 50s then, with the rise of television, the studio system started to
It was the late 40s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so who took advantage of that? Who were the powerful people in Hollywood that took advantage of this gap in power?
Interesting question. I think some independent producers and directors came along. One notably was Stanley Kramer, who made The Defiant Ones and Judgment at Nuremberg. And it was the beginning of independent production as we know it now, where people are really putting together pictures and bringing them to studios rather than them originating within the studio, which sometimes happens, but very often it's somebody coming with a project to the studio.
Well, you talk about in this book, you look at a number of actors and performers who really became powerful in this new Hollywood, who could get a movie made with their clout. Clint Eastwood strikes me as one who has kind of transcended almost all the others in terms of his longevity. I think I once saw that there was a list of the top 10 box office draws by decade, and he was one of the few that stayed on the list for more than one decade, because the taste generally changed much quicker than that.
I mean, Clint, that's really an extraordinary career. He started directing after he was a successful actor.
He started in TV, right?
Was at Rawhide, I think. Mm-hmm. And then he went and made Italian Westerns with Sierra J. Leone. And I believe Clint just gets better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now in his 80s, and he's still directing and still doing it very well.
Mm-hmm. Did Hollywood have trouble in this new, in the 50s and 60s with the rise of, especially in the 60s, with the rise of youth culture and pop culture? Did old Hollywood have a hard time responding to that, because it seemed like a time when everyone was suddenly chasing the newest trend and sometimes flopping magnificently? Was that a difficult time?
It was confusing for them. And I think you're talking about Francis Coppola and
the Roger Corman. Roger Corman was somebody who successfully tapped into that.
Well, Roger, he's in this book, and he was an independent producer, director.
Right.
And Roger made films for quarters.
Right.
It was all about how he could make a picture for the least amount of money. And so many others in this book started with Roger Corman.
Who were some of the people that it's a legendary list, but who were some of his people?
Peter Bogdanovich, Jack Nicholson got his start in Roger Corman movies. Robert Towne, the writer, who is in the book.
Did the Coen brothers early on?
No,
they
don't.
They didn't.
I don't think the Coen brothers. I think Marty Scorsese made a picture for Roger. And he was, and Roger was good. He'd say, okay, you've got $13,000 to make this movie. I'm not going to bother you as long as you're getting it shot. And it, so it gave people a kind of independence to go ahead and try themselves at making movies. And it was very important. And Roger continues doing it, and Roger directed pictures, and he's just a very smart man, a very civilized man. He looks a little bit like a banker or a lawyer.
This is Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm talking to George Stevens Jr. about his book Conversations at the American Film Institute with Great Movie Makers, The Next Generation, coming from Knopf. Well, two of the real sort of giants of this new Hollywood that you talk about in the book, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. And now, of course, their success is kind of just a huge fact. It's something that we all know about. But actually, George Lucas had a lot of, there was a lot of controversy surrounding Star Wars originally. It was not a movie that people were jumping over each other to make, right?
No, and he finally got 20th Century Fox to do it. And
who passed on it? Was it Columbia who passed on it, or who was the
studio? I forget, but he kind of shopped it around.
Yeah.
And once 20th Century Fox said they would do it, George just had one condition. He said, I want to retain the sequel and merchandising rights. And they barely want to make this picture, so they said, well, we can give him that.
There's no future to this thing.
And they gave away $1 billion in one conversation. You know what I think is interesting, Andy? When we started the AFI school in Los Angeles, the Center for Advanced Film Studies, the first year, in 1969, there were 17 fellows. And on the first night, Harold Lloyd, the great silent film director and comedian, came to do the first of these seminars, which are now called the Harold Lloyd Seminars. And in that room that night, among these 17 people, were Terrence Malick, David Lynch, Caleb Deschanel, the great cinematographer, mm-hmm. Paul Schrader, the writer of Taxi Driver. And it was really the beginning of something. And what makes these conversations, I think, more interesting, Picasso said, when critics get together, they talk about theory. When artists get together, they talk about turpentine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these people are talking about turpentine, how you make films. And it really digs into how do you work with actors, how do you collaborate. And I think from that standpoint, they're quite unique.
Well, they're demystifying it a little bit. They are, because it is all about the nuts and bolts. Spielberg and George Lucas had a big impact on our coverage of film too, our media coverage of film, because their films did so well at the box office that box office returns suddenly became a big story. How did that evolve?
I don't know. It used to be you had to go to Variety to find out how much a picture grossed, kind of thinking that that's for the people in the business. And now it's you know, the New York Times is reporting the box office grosses and all the other.
Well, everyone's grandmother knows what the top 10 buy. I mean, it's just part of the news. And, you know, then, you know, Entertainment Tonight, you know, sort of made that, turned everybody into a Variety subscriber.
And from my standpoint, I think it sometimes guides the audience in away from very good films if they read that such and such a film opened and it only did $30,000 in New York City. People kind of stay away from it, which I think is unfortunate.
Right. The box office becomes kind of this tool for encouraging a herd mentality. Well, everyone else has seen it, so you have to see it too.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a big difference between, you wrote this book about the earlier generation of filmmakers and now this generation. The earlier generation grew up in Hollywood watching silent film. And this generation is more likely to have grown up with television and sound film. And now, of course, people entering the business now, a lot of them aren't even watching movies at movie theaters. They're watching them on their computer or their, you know, iPad or whatever. Do you think something has been lost in this, or do you think it's just an inevitable change?
Well, I think both. I think it's inevitable, and I think it has been lost. When you think about that first generation, the filmmakers of the golden age, they had no models. Mm-hmm. It was just a kind of a breathtaking period of innovation because they saw relatively few films. And as you say, that most of the films they saw were silent films. This generation, many of them went to film school. Mm-hmm. Films are now accessible, on DVD. So people have seen everything. So they're guided more. And you never heard the directors of the Golden Age doing homages to another filmmaker.
Right.
They were doing as we would say, their own thing.
What did you think of, just as a film guy, but also as an audience member, what did you think of the artist and the acclaim surrounding the artist? Did that strike you as an exciting new development, making a silent film in black and white, or what was your feeling about that?
I just found it delightful. Mm-hmm. I thought it was such a lovely film. I went to see it twice in the theater, and I think it was a great. It gets back to the thing of how difficult it is. These people had to scrap together money to make that film, and they made the film, and then Harvey Weinstein saw it and realized how good it was, and they were in business. But it was a very courageous thing to go that special path.
Now, you also have a great conversation in the book with Steven Spielberg in 1978, which is, just to go back in time, it's a year past Close Encounters and right before Raiders of the Lost Ark and E.T., and he said this is a pressure cooker for a director, just being in front of the next generation of filmmakers at AFI. Was he nervous to answer their questions?
Well, he indicated he was, and I thought that was charming. And these two, we combined two seminars that Stephen did, and they were early in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so instructive about, you know, now we know him as a legendary, I think it's fair to say, mm-hmm. filmmaker, and that he was just like everybody else. He was kind of sneaking onto the Universal lot, and he'd made his little 8mm films and Jaws. He went up to Martha's Vineyard with David Brown and Dick Zanuck were the producers, and they were supposed to be there 8 weeks, and they were there 4 months because the inflatable shark didn't work. And Stephen is staying in some motel in Martha's Vineyard, thinking his very promising career is going down the drain because this film is almost unmakeable. And then it turns out to be a landmark, life-changing movie, Jaws.
Of course. I'm speaking with George Stevens Jr. about his book, Conversations at the American Film Institute with Great Movie Makers, The Next Generation. It's published by Knopf, and we'll have more right after this break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate here at WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm really enjoying this conversation with the great George Stevens Jr. He has a new book, Conversations at the American Film Institute with the Great Movie Makers, The Next Generation from the 1950s to Hollywood Today. It's new from Knopf. He has won 15 Emmys, 2 Peabodys, the Humanitas Prize, and 7 Writers Guild Awards. I just had to sneak that in there. That's a lot of hardware.
Well, the fix was in.
Now, this is, it's interesting to me. You grew up, of course, second generation Hollywood, son of one of the great directors, George Stevens. Would you come to the set as a boy? Would you go see your dad at work?
A minor amendment. Actually, I'm fourth generation.
Fourth generation. I didn't know Hollywood was around that
well,
long.
Well, it's extraordinary. I'm doing a little writing about this, so it's much on my mind. But both of my grandmothers and both of my grandfathers were actors. My mother's mother, Alice Howell, mm-hmm. was a silent film star. She worked with Chaplin and Tilly's Punctured Romance and then starred in her own films. I have a poster behind my desk saying the funniest girl on the screen, Alice Howell. And my father's mother and father, Lander Stevens and Georgie Cooper, were very prominent theater actors in San Francisco and then came to the movies. But the fourth generation comes from my great-grandmother, Georgia Woodthorpe, who was the star of the theater in San Francisco, played Ophelia to Edwin Booth's Hamlet.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's a lot of history there. And it makes me forget what the question you asked was.
Well, I didn't really ask a question. I was just, my jaw was really just dropping over all of your awards. But now I'm really, now I'm filled with indignation about what an unfair advantage you had.
Because absolutely.
You had, you, I guess the fix really was in. You had a lot of history there. Were you, did you ever consider doing anything else with your life except show business? Was it always, did you ever have a rebellious teenage phase?
Well,
I'll be an accountant.
Not so rebellious, no. I wouldn't go that far. I was interested in sports writing.
Uh-huh.
I always wrote. But I went into it fairly directly, and then had a kind of a life-changing thing when Edward R. Murrow asked me to come back to Washington in 1962 and run the motion picture division of USIA, which put me into the Kennedy New Frontier, into politics and government. So I've had that kind of bifurcated experience of being in show business and in Washington.
Well, tell me, I want to get to the USIA in a minute, because that's a pretty important part of your career. But I'm curious to know what, you know, growing up with your dad as a director, what were the turpentine moments with him? Did he impart any lessons to you about what makes a film work, or what his technique was?
Largely by observation.
Mm-hmm. Just by seeing him work.
I was in the editing with him. I worked on Location and Shane. Worked with him on the screenplay of Giant. But he, most important thing he said to me, Andy, that really stayed with me, two things. One, to respect the audience.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the studios were saying the audience has the mentality of a 13-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to talk down to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this wonderful lesson to respect the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was when we were actually coming back from the Academy Awards the year he won the Oscar for A Place in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
He was driving the car, and the Oscar was on the seat between us. And I was excited, and maybe he thought I was too excited. And he smiled and he said, "We'll have a better idea what kind of a film this is in about 25 years.
Interesting.
And that idea of the test of time, and it kind of relates to two things you said. Yes, I had this very privileged situation to be around a great storyteller, creator, which maybe is what led me to create a film school for others. And, you know, that was a real opportunity for me.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to George Stevens Jr. here at WNYC and WNYC.org. I, just from my observation of being on film sets, I don't think there's any job more grueling than being a film director. I mean, just the hours and the physical endurance alone. Was it really a draining, punishing experience for your dad, or is that just my impression?
No, it really was. And it's not just that you're, you know, say you're making Shane up in Jackson Hole and you've got the weather and all of the complications that come with a big enterprise. And you also have the studio, which is questioning and wondering why you're shooting so much film. In the book, Arthur Penn says, well, really, the studio doesn't really produce the film. They police it. And
mm-hmm.
he said they come up to Montana and ask me why I'm shooting so much film. And that really comes through when you, with Alan Pakula, Arthur Penn, Sidney Pollack in this book, that you have so much on your shoulders when you're making a film. Just logistically,
mm-hmm.
and then at the same time, you've got to be a poet. You've got to be working with actors, remembering what the story is, and gathering the film that will enable you to complete it in the editing room.
Well, it's a very unrelated series of skills, because there might be somebody who's a great visual artist but is terrible with people, and vice versa. So it's sort of remarkable when they all find themselves in one person.
It really is. I mean, you think of, I mean, that generation of directors that I looked up to, David Lean and Frank Capra and William Wyler and Fred Zinnemann, they were such strong people that they were able to cope with all that and still keep their eye on the story and the audience.
Did you ever think that you wanted to be a director like your dad? I know you've done a lot of different, almost, you know, you know, you're a Renaissance man in terms of all the things you've done, but you didn't want to be the big Hollywood A-list director. Was that a temptation at some point, or did you think it was not for you?
Well, I started out directing. I directed Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Peter Gunn and worked with mm-hmm. Jack Webb when I was in my mid-20s. So I think I was on a path to spending my life trying to become the second best director in my family.
That's no fun. So you chose a different path. Well, that seems
well,
like...
The different path chose me, really.
Uh-huh. Now, one thing that you talk about in the book, in a lot of these conversations, which is interesting, is the role that luck can play in an actor's life in terms of getting a part. You mentioned you have the great story of Jack Lemmon getting the part in Mr. Roberts. How did that play out? Because that was such a huge thing for his career.
Yes, he was on the studio lot, and the great John Ford was on the lot, and Jack ran into this guy with a patch on his eye and chewing a handkerchief, and he thought he was a grip or something. Anyway, Jack Ford saw a test that Jack made for another picture and cast him in Mr. Roberts.
And Sidney Poitier, who, of course, has had such an astonishing career, got off to a very bad start, and he did a play, a theatrical version of Lysistrata.
Yeah.
What was that? That sounds like it was sort of a train wreck.
Sidney, to me, he's a miracle. He's a dear friend, so I speak from a point of view of prejudice. But when you think that he came to America from the Bahamas, not speaking English the way we speak it, hopped a freight train to New York, and learned to speak English listening to the radio under the tutelage of a Jewish waiter, and then became, against all odds, one of our most elegant and persuasive and impressive actors. It's a great... I mean, I think it's one of the great American stories.
There's a theme in the book is fear. That you know, we think of these people as icons, and yet there were moments... almost every time, I guess, you start something new in Hollywood, it's kind of scary if you care about it.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep is somebody who seems so completely regal on the screen and in command. What kind of fear does she talk about in the book?
Well, she talks about that every time she starts a picture, despite all her successes, she has a kind of nausea. Will it be for me, be there for me this time? I love Meryl talking about Sophie's Choice, mm-hmm. which she did with the late Alan Pakula, the director. And she knew the story. She'd read the story. But she said when she read the screenplay, she barely looked at the last scene where Sophie has to make a choice between her two daughters.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I didn't want that clouding my performance because Sophie was a woman with two men in love with her, and I wanted to have that buoyancy. And the night before we shot the scene, I read it, and I was ready for it.
Mm.
And she said Sophie hadn't looked at the last pages of her life. And it seems to me that Meryl is just so extraordinary, perceptive, and her ability to play Sophie and Margaret Thatcher, the whole range.
Julia Child.
Yeah, Julia Child.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a real treasure.
Now, one piece of this is just small, I guess, a trivia note in the book, but I thought it was fascinating, was that Paul Schrader, the screenwriter, admits that he never wrote the most famous line in Taxi Driver, "You talking to me?" How did that come out?
Well, that was just something he volunteered. Yes,
it's amazing. Well, it's a wonderful book. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you so much success with it. It's really been an honor to have you here.
Thank you, Andy. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks so much. I've been speaking with George Stevens Jr. His book, Conversations at the American Film Institute with the Great Movie Makers, The Next Generation, is published by Knopf, and he'll be in conversation with Foster Hirsch tonight at 6 at the Players Club. For more information, visit our show page. And George, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book.